Welcome to Happy Path Programming. I'm Bruce Eckel.
I'm James Ward. All right. Well, welcome, everyone. Today, I'm excited to have with us Ollie Drotbaum. And you, we've interacted for, over a decade. You've been up here to Crested Butte to the Java Posse Roundup.
You said twice,
ago.
Right?
Twice.
Yeah, 2009, 2012.
Actually. Nice. Okay. Awesome. And so great to have you on. You, you work on the Spring team currently, right?
Yeah, thanks for having me in the first place.
Yeah.
Okay. I've been an engineer on the Spring team for over a decade now. So.
Wow.
I've done a couple of different things, primarily the Spring Data stuff, so all the repository abstractions in there.
Yeah.
That's been what I've done with a team of four or five people now.
Nice.
But yeah, I've moved on into some different topics, architecturally related topics recently.
Nice.
And that's actually one of the things that I'm really interested in kind of picking your brain about, because you've done lots of work in domain-driven design.
The Spring Data project or the repository abstraction like tightly connects to that, right? There is this concept of a repository in domain-driven design, kind of simulating a collection of aggregates, basically, and being able to select subsets of those aggregates through an API. And we've built a Java programming model around this. That's become pretty popular. I think it's the third most downloaded Spring project within the ecosystem.
Wow. Okay. So to get started, I want to talk. So this mug.
Yeah.
Which our listeners can't see, but
our listeners can't see.
It's a very nice mug. It even has your name on it.
It has my name on it. So what happened? And this was 2013. So 10 years ago.
Okay.
And Eric Evans invited a group of us to what he called the DDD Summit. And this was based on some of the events that I had here in Crested Butte, because Eric had come to at least a couple of them. And he said, I want to do something. I see how it works. I want to do something like that around domain-driven design. Mm-hmm. And so I went with Barry Hawkins, who at least for a couple of years worked with Eric, to try and, turn domain-driven design into, I think they were looking at creating a training and consulting firm around it. And I think that what I came away with was that Eric felt at the time that he was disappointed that it hadn't gained traction.
Really?
At the time. It wasn't,
How old is his book?
Well, his book had been...
So the book was before this. So.
Oh, yeah. The book had been out...
it's 2003 or 2004, actually.
Oh, okay. The book had been out for 10 years. And it's like, no, it wasn't taken off. It wasn't taken off. And now...
So let's do a summit.
Yeah. Maybe that's what he was hoping for. And I think he did want to ask, what should we do about this? It's, it's kind of like maybe what John DeGose has been doing with Scala recently. Yeah. And he was disappointed at its lack of traction. But now it seems like in the last couple of years, probably longer, people are all about domain-driven design. And can you tell us,
first, what is domain-driven design?
Well, yes, definitely.
What is the
basic? Because I read, little pieces of the book, but not. Yes. I never really immersed myself in it. So, what problem are you trying to solve with domain-driven design?
So, I can give you the story how I discovered the book, basically. I think it's been one of the books that has most fundamentally changed the way I look at building software. Both on the, let's say, higher level point of views, which systems to build, where are the boundaries, that kind of stuff. And also on the, let's say, more down to the code aspects, the concepts and building blocks Eric mentions in the book. So there's basically two big parts, one being the strategic design, which is all about which systems do you actually build, what scopes do you have, the famous bounded context notion, how they interact with each other, how they relate to each other, who's controlling certain parts of the model and kind of
those sound like those architectural decisions.
Right, exactly. Okay. So it's kind of that's the bigger systems kind of organization part of it. The book, however, starts with like the concept of ubiquitous language. So trying to put the business language into code, and also describes a couple of patterns, I'd say, that you find in code that, which you kind of use to organize your code, implement certain tasks or responsibilities like scopes of consistency and whatnot. So that's the technical design part. Hmm. And a lot of people actually stop when they're past this because the book is pretty big, actually. Yeah.
There's a lot of concepts in it. So
yeah,
people often just maybe take the easy ones. And
I have to admit, I mean, I started as a junior developer back in the days, and those patterns were the things that drew me to the book because it was immediately useful for me in my day-to-day work. Whereas the other stuff is kind of like, of course, architectural stuff that's important as well. But as a day-to-day developer, you're kind of not really in the position to decide, okay, we change the whole systems landscape, organize teams around it. But hey, if I can improve the code that I write to some degree by applying these patterns, that's a win in the first place, right? And that's what kind of drew me to the book.
So there's almost like a inherent scale to the problems that it's trying to solve, is that there are some things that apply to an individual developer on a team and can be very useful in that context. And then there's other concepts that would apply kind of more to someone in a architecture role that is working with many teams and thinking about the system as a whole and that sort of thing. Would that
exactly. I mean, it's a kind of a holistic view or like approach to software development, and allows you to, like, depending on what kind of your role is in an organization or as a consultant, and what kind of people you talk to, you can always find something to kind of improve the current situation, whether that's like a messy code base and you try to like organize that a bit. But if you're like talking to teams or the HR department that is kind of setting up the teams to actually solve problems overall, then you rather like try to fine tune those, like with all the Conway's law stuff and what have you, right? So it's kind of, it's such a big thing that you always find something that you can take forward to like improve the software you build. So
can you give us the essence of, I mean, I don't know, maybe we should start at the individual programmer level. How does that change? What mindset changes do you experience when you're coding?
So what it did for me was that, the key piece was that kind of you have this ubiquitous language, and to be able to connect to the business and eventually provide value, you have to talk the language of the problem, or the problem space, and by that the people that are busy with the problem space. So I was like really into naming things, right? How do you find good names? How do you make sure that the gap between the problem and the code is as small as possible? And that's kind of to find the right abstraction levels, getting away from like technical concepts to, let's say, more higher level concepts.
Because that was like the promise of object-oriented programming, right? We can create our objects to represent problem domain things.
Sure. And I mean, different languages like give you different opportunities to like do that, right? To build, I'm not saying DSLs, but rather like write code that has expresses the problem domain. But this, at least like in the code bases that I see at customer projects, for example, there's often a lot of room for improvement to actually do that, to just basically name things better and by that make things more expressive. There is this great talk by Dunberg Jonsson, the value objects talk. I think if you Google it on this and one on InfoQ.
I'll find it and put it in the
InfoQ has a recording. I can find out the link, where he basically takes a code base that's very technical and driven by frameworks and what have you. It's about like money exchange and exchange rates. And he just adds tiny things like value objects to the code base and ends up with a piece of code that just like reads like the actual problem statement. And that's even Java, right? So it's kind of like, it's not like the most the most convenient language to build, let's say, an API that's not like with curly braces and what have you. You don't have all that powerful language syntax that you have in Kotlin, for example, right? With where you can much more shape the text that you have to write to.
Yeah, the data modeling. There's kind of more ceremony maybe in Java for the data modeling.
Right. Now, when you say value object, is that could that be like, well, for example, I mean, the languages that I'm studying now have a focus on immutable data structures. Mm-hmm. Is that what you would call a value object?
Yeah, sure. I mean, it's like representing domain concepts that are values and mm-hmm. that allow you to like perform a certain, like not business operations, but again, speak the language of the business. Let's say that's the classic example of an email address, right? It's not just an arbitrary string that you carry through the system, but it's actually, it follows some structure. It has a local part, it has a server part, and you can access those and you can do things to that. And if you hand this over to some other piece of code, that other piece of code can be sure that it's structurally an email address. It's not just an arbitrary string, but it's that particular domain concept, right? You don't have to validate it anymore. You get that, you actually just use the type system to express domain concepts. So let the compiler help you like check the correctness of your application code.
And convey to people reading the code what the business oriented side of it is.
Yeah. And not have these like stringly typed method parameters like string first name, string last name, string email address, and then you mix up the order of that stuff. Yeah. But rather have like explicit like name class or an email address class or whatever.
So is the essence of this that we have business needs that we're trying to address? How do we map those business needs to the code that we're actually writing in a way that has cohesion?
And it also sounds like what some people have been calling data structure oriented design.
I haven't heard that one.
I mean, it's when you have the immutable data structures and you go, well, what should they be? They should be something that relate, well, at least maybe my interpretation is they should relate to the problem domain. So your data structure should be something somebody can look at and go, oh yeah, those are the pieces that we want to manipulate. Hmm.
The data structures, like the term, at least in the Java world, it's a bit of a tricky one because data structure is usually understood as something where you have like getters and setters, like this Java bean concept on it, which kind of is a bit subverting some ideas of DDD because you wouldn't want to expose those internal structures to your calling code, but rather basically capture state when you create an instance, and then that instance is able to answer questions around the domain rather than basically handing out all the values that it consists of.
So, the encapsulation idea.
Exactly. So that's also a reason that records that have been like added quite recently to the Java language, they are a bit of a special thing here. So some people really dislike them for exactly that fact that they kind of...
Well, because it goes against what they, including me, have been taught all this time is, you want to have variables inside of these data structures and you want to protect them through encapsulation, et cetera. This idea of a record where everything is exposed is definitely a mind shift. But once you see it, then you go, we don't actually need encapsulation if we've got immutable data structures.
It's kind of a neat tool where you especially like these single value objects like an email address or what have you, where you at some point, especially at the boundaries of your application, you need the raw value again, right? If you want to like serialize it into some JSON or what have you, or have to actually put it into some database column, but you actually get, or you are able to express the concept in a very concise way, so that you can then have that particular type that you carry around that's matching the business requirements of basically just the email address format. Whereas like before records, you'd have to create a class, final field, constructor, equals, hash code, write all this down, or have your IDE write this all into your
or use an external editor, tool like
and
whatever
that's causing a lot of boilerplate, which then in turn caused people not like using these classes because it's just so much boilerplate code, right?
So, exactly. And it's leaking some of the system needs into the business domain space, which I think domain-driven design is trying to say that, no, let's keep our business domain focused on the business domain.
Sure.
And exactly. At some point, yes, you need to take that object and serialize it, and there's different system needs that may come into play, but let's keep that as like a separate concern.
Yeah. So it's kind of have to get a feel for when using a record is like, or that record concept in Java is the right thing. For simple values, it's perfectly fine. It's just that if you basically try to, let's say, have your entire customer modeled as a record, just because it's immutable, then it's kind of still, yeah, I don't know.
It's definitely a mental shift. But once I started seeing it, I'm going, oh yeah, of course. Of course, if I was to ever rewrite one of my Java books, it would be records, unless you're forced to not use records. And usually that's only an efficiency issue.
Yeah.
So an example of this is maybe you can, I think often maybe pre-domain driven design and adoption of that, oftentimes your data layer would model how you needed to store the data in the database. And somebody would look at your data layer and be like, if somebody was looking at it from the business perspective, be like, why is it organized like this? Mm-hmm. And the answer would be, oh, that's because that's how the database needs it to be organized. But in domain-driven design, you say, no, let's keep the layer for the business oriented totally around the business needs and business domain. And then we can transform from that layer to the database, the way that the database needs the data actually stored.
Right. And if you use a different kind of database, then you can change your transformation. It's not hardwired
without having to change
into the structure.
Yeah.
I guess that's the heart of what you just said is hidden in these, or is also represented in these like onion architecture and hexagonal architecture approaches, where you have your core domain that really focuses on like trying to write as pure as possible code that represents the domain. And then you have some kind of adapters or like rings in onion architecture that translate that into like the infrastructure, right? Into the database.
Or the UI, the way that the
or
UI.
API or basically
or an API. Yeah,
yeah.
Mm-hmm.
UI.
Yeah.
So what now, early, I can't remember the phrase you used, but you were saying, okay, we want everything to map to, as much as possible, the business domain. What about, like in functional programming, we have all of these kind of, well, for functional, it's low-level primitive things like the map and the fold and the things like that, which allow us to not, basically, it allows for greater code reuse and greater reliability. You know, we're not having to write everything by hand. We're writing at a slightly higher level. But does that intrude on some of the ideas in domain-driven design, or are they compatible?
That's an interesting question, because I've come across this quite a lot when I've seen projects, and also like the projects I've been involved in have used libraries called Waver. I'm not sure if you've heard of that.
I am not familiar.
It's basically trying to transport some of the concepts you have in Scala into Java, like a try monad. And it nudges you to write a bit more functional code in Java. And I've used that in a couple of projects to some success. So it's all working fine. The effect it has on the code is a bit of I'm a bit torn on this one, because you introduce a language that's familiar to us as developers, like, as you said, Bruce, with like the folds and the maps and what have you. That's not necessarily the language of the domain. In fact, it could even shadow concepts of the domain. If the method of filter, like if you talk to someone from the chemistry domain, right? Is that when you say filter, do you describe what you try to keep or what you want to let through? Right?
Yeah, so that's kind of inclusion.
Just having that additional language in there can be like beneficial to people understanding that language and the technical language. But at the same time, it's also a bit alien to business code to some degree. So
yes, that's really my question.
That the names the names are oriented around the actual like
mathematical
concepts, not oriented around the business.
And yeah, because you talked about the common language. And so that's what made me think, okay, I mean, really, yes, when you're using a filter, you say, all right, the essence of the filter is not the action of filtering, which is standardized and debugged, but this little usually lambda or whatever function we pass that describes what we're filtering for. And so that, you know, I think you could say, okay, that's the language of the domain, but you're just not used to having these higher level tools that functional programming provides for you, or the error handling models that functional programming uses.
I think the error handling one is a really interesting example, because if in your domain model you're getting the data from a database or a microservice or whatever, then that's something that may fail. And do you put like the try monad into your business domain when the business domain doesn't care at all that the thing failed, right? It's just, and so that's, it seems like a place where it could easily leak in, where you're leaking in the actual technical details into the business domain.
What I found quite useful, and it's often, or that's also actually coming from DDD, and I see a lot of people like, not doing that, is kind of modeling these error scenarios as explicit as part of the domain, right? So not trying to, okay, there's an exception or anything, or even a try, like an error result. It's just that, okay, the, let's say the request, the account request is just in some particular state that that is like erroneous, that someone has to look at it, or we have to perform some actions on it, but it's actually that error state is a valid state within the application, right? Or within the software application, not the contract application, for example. So that often like is a bit of a switch in how people can think about stuff and not try to, oh, there's this exception that we throw and then we handle this someplace and then we just display a message to the user and then they have to deal with it. But rather, okay, this thing has a new state that represents a problem, right? So that's kind of...
Yeah, or you look something up. Yeah, I mean, you look up the name of a user and that may not exist. And that's a legitimate thing in your business domain.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Sure.
We thought, we looked up the user on, they don't have an account. Well, that's a totally legitimate.
The example I usually give there is like, if you have, let's say an e-commerce application and you have to keep track of stock of products, right? And then there's of course this easy way to say, oh, I have 4 TVs in my inventory and someone wants to order 5. So I throw an exception and basically say, you can't order these 5 TVs. But what if we just like model this as a perfectly valid state and then draw some conclusions from that overdraw, right? So basically say, okay, people, we have to basically reorder stock, right? So turn this into a signal that after like you cross a certain threshold, you'd have to do other business activity to solve that problem.
And it seems like the easy naive approach is just to throw the exception and let the caller deal with it. But that's not necessarily in line with what the business needs are, because it could very well be that the business actually wants the person to place that order, and that then they want to, like you said, have other business strategies to then rectify the problem or something.
Mm-hmm. That's exactly the point, right? I want to get the developers back to realizing, in this problem there's a business opportunity, or at least some discussion to be had.
Yeah, what does the business want to do in this scenario?
Should we really reject that order? Like, and why? And isn't there an opportunity for us to actually improve?
We can sell you 3 now, and then the others will come because we're going to order them.
I think this is, it's so valuable to, in the world has shifted for developers. it used to be long ago, 20 years ago, when I was writing a bunch of business systems, that there was the business, there was the business analyst, and then there was me, the developer. And that business analyst was responsible for translating, discovering and translating the requirements of the business to a specification that then I would go implement. And it seems like that business analyst role has in some ways evaporated. And now it's the developer who is having to understand what the business needs are and implement them more directly. And maybe domain-driven design is the best way for developers to create that cohesion across that.
The movie Office Space was so prescient here because they had the guy who kept explaining, yeah, I take the requirements from the business people and then I bring them to the developers. There's your business analyst.
I have people skills.
I mean, isn't that at the heart of the like agile software development movement? So it's like developers talking to business people and in collaboration basically build stuff that's useful. So
yeah
instead of them throwing them over the wall and saying build this and wait, well, not what I imagined that it was going to be.
Exactly. The reason why I think that role has evaporated is because it was like the telephone game where there was this, you know, loss of information as you worked through that chain. And I think through agile and domain driven design discovered that, oh, let's just, instead of playing the telephone game, let's just have the developers addressing the business.
We'll just give the developers the people skills to talk to the customers.
I mean, I guess that's the role of modern business analysts, right? It's to foster that translation and that communication. So agile, I think approaches. There's still room for that skill, especially as like often developers are not that skilled at that. But
the business domains are incredibly complex. Always asking the developers to fully understand the business domain has its own challenges.
Yeah, it's work.
Yeah. So did we miss any big pieces of domain-driven
design? No, I have a question. Okay. I have a question. So I feel like we've mostly kind of danced around the low-level stuff.
Sure.
But now I want to know, all right, so from an architectural standpoint, how do you approach a project from a DDD standpoint? How do you like start architecting such a thing?
That's a broad question, right? Because depending on like what kind of role you're in and like what stuff you're looking at, what the context is in which you have to develop the application. What I usually do when I'm getting like involved in customer projects and they ask me to help them architect any kind of software is that I let them present their functional decomposition first. So like, what are the big pieces? What does your system look like from a like functional separation point of view, right? You often get like C4 model architecture diagrams from Simon Brown's C4 model. Kind of helps.
Is this a way to describe the business, the business objectives and what they want from the system or what they've built with the system?
I guess, I mean, I just like basically started from the discussion from, oh, there's an existing system point of view, right? If you want to help me understand that. If you start from scratch, then I, of course, think you have to look at the organization and what kind of teams you already have, what are they working on. That might give you not like an ideal situation, but just the state of the system you have. And then the question of, okay, what do we actually want to build, right? So what's the kind of thing? What business value do we want to provide, and how does that fit into the current arrangement? Because I mean,
so you're trying to work with Conway's Law, then?
Yeah, I mean, it's you try to align with that, right? Because there's no point in being at odds with that, and there's hardly any real greenfield development at all anywhere. Because I mean, just a week after you've started, then you've kind of just changed.
No longer greenfield,
But that's kind of the idea here, and it's of course it's a process, right? It's not something here's the thing, the way you do that. It's you could There's like Alberto Brandolini's event storming, right? To understand what the business is doing and then trying to find those individual pieces, get to the bounded context, basically areas of business of the business domain that have to be conflict free in terms of their language. So when I say order and you say order, we mean the same thing. But if Bruce says order, he might mean something different. And then you kind of get a feel for where the boundaries are or where you could put them in place reasonably well. So because it's, especially if you're new to a domain, then it's always like a bit of guesswork involved. And then it's just, I guess, a question of how to establish the boundaries in a way that you can basically... Good fences make good neighbors, right? You put them in place first, but might be able to also tweak and alter them in a reasonable way so that it's not as expensive. Yeah.
So an example of this, I like the order one, is that if you don't define your boundaries and the context that everyone is seeing different things through, ultimately, what you're going to get is an order object that some of the fields are for this business unit, some of the fields are for this business unit, and some of the fields are for this business unit. And domain-driven design would maybe say that that's a red flag, that you haven't bounded the context well.
Mm-hmm. So the example is pretty great because if you naively look at this stuff, and I mean, I've been guilty, or I am still guilty of this myself, because when I build example projects, they are usually very simplistic, right? And then you have your order, and then you have your inventory, and then you have your catalog with your products. So it's very entity centric, and you're very, because that's okay. My domain is very simple, right? My product has a price and that's it. Whereas in the real world, it just isn't as simple, right? Pricing can be the most complex thing in the world. And you have like tons of different aspects playing into this. And then the entire pricing and product thing could become a separate bounded context.
Yeah.
It's usually like shipment and invoicing that all touch order and customer to some degree, right? They all have a particular view on the order, right? Invoicing is interested in tax rates. Shipment is interested in the dimensions of the product boxes or what have you, but not in tax rates. So,
if you talk to different teams within an organization, they're going to have different needs on what an order is to them.
Exactly.
And so, in domain-driven design, you don't try to assimilate all of that into a Uber order object. You instead say, this is the order object for what this team needs, and this is the order object for what this team needs.
Well, I would think there would also be an essence of an order object that is going to be the same common for every team. And then when they get that, they go, oh, I'll embed it in our thing, and we'll do our stuff with it. And then when we're ready to pass it on, we just take the embedded part and pass it on to you. Is that
there usually is like one of these like systems or like parts of the system that kind of establish the identity of something, and then the other like systems or parts of the system refer to that identity so that you can of course correlate the different ideas of an order, quote unquote, to the same logical thing. But I've seen like projects where you didn't even have like any kind of shared information at all. It's just like all just an identifier, and then everyone else has the info that they need, and then just like in an eventually consistent way exchange, oh, I've done an update to that thing that I have, and everyone else is just pulling out the things that the aspects that they are interested in, because there usually of course is some overlap that doesn't necessarily mean that you have to kind of use a shared data structure or anything like that.
And all of this should be tangential to the actual storage mechanism that's required by different parts of the system.
Sure.
And I think that that's probably an important shift for me in what I've gone through, is I would initially long ago design a system about how I wanted to store the data. And with domain-driven design, it says, no, start with the business needs and then figure out how each piece of that needs to actually store the data or pass it to another system or whatever may be presented.
Because if you do that, you can then actually do what you wanted to do in the first place, choose the best data store for the problem at hand, yeah. Right? So whether it's a relational database, some document store, or graph database, if you need to do recommendations or what have you. So
the argument is, I came across this recently, because the argument is, oh, well, this allows you to change the database. And people were going, you know what? That never happens.
Yeah.
So that's not a good, but it sounds like the better argument is, okay, we're abstracting that away so that we don't get muddled up with those details when we're talking about the concepts from the business standpoint. It really seems like we're trying to bring programmers away from all the, you know, low-level stuff that they think about in terms of solving this problem, and just educating them in, hey, you're solving a real problem for a real person, and we should talk about that problem in those contexts. And it seems like that's kind of what it is.
I mean, that this coupling, decoupling discussion is something that comes up in a lot of discussions I have with teams, because of course, I mean, there is this notion in domain-driven design that discussed this before, that you want to like be in you have your pure domain code, and then you would want to at the boundaries of your application, you kind of map that into some infrastructure, right, into some database. At the same time, and Onion architecture, for example, kind of suggests that you have this outer ring, and then in that ring you have your APIs that produce JSON, and you have your database that, let's say, map onto a database table. I don't really like that picture too much, because there's a significant difference in the translation mechanisms. As you said, Bruce, in recent applications, the application team usually also owns the data store, right? And there is a direct connection, or you can actually make a more direct connection to that data store. You can simplify the mapping. You can even, let's say, go ahead and avoid an additional layer of mapping, because that all also comes with complexity. Whereas, let's say, for the API, right, if you expose something to third parties, you're not controlling that other model, right? That thing, and you can't like arbitrarily change it. Whereas if I have a customer and the customer has a first name and the last name, then I want to have my table to have a customer and the last name field. I don't want any kind of mapping in between so that the thing in the database could be called something different, because that's all just like cognitive overload that I have to deal with then, right? So I want these models to be close from some point of view. I still want to make sure that I can use my domain code without the database running, without the database in place. But that's a different kind of aspect of the decoupling like discussion, right? And I definitely think that you can have different trade-offs depending on whether it's the target model is something that you control or something that you don't control in the API case, for which it probably makes a bit of sense to have an additional mapping step in between. But at the same time, of course, if you have the customer has a first name and a last name, there will be a first name and a last name field in the JSON representation, right? So it's kind of it's a more subtle discussion than like, oh, our domain is pure, and then we decouple this completely from our database, because
you go too far with trying to create isolation when you may not need it.
And I took this off from Bruce's comment about the we want to exchange the database. Was it you, Bruce, or was it?
Oh, you might change the database. And
that's hard. That's not really. It's not going to happen anyway. And if you build your system in that way, then you're also losing out a lot on the actual capabilities of the specialized thing that you actually selected in the first place.
Right.
You select the graph database because you want to make use of the nature of the store.
It's a fundamental architectural decision.
Exactly. Yeah. And it's not something, I mean, you could argue that you would want to exchange one graph database for another, or one relational database for another. But if activities like these or if these are the main tasks you have to perform on a day-to-day basis, you're not probably going to earn any money, right? So you're not delivering the thing you want to necessarily optimize for.
Solving a different problem, yeah.
Being able to ship features, right? That's kind of the thing.
I want to shift to microservices and monoliths, but I think there's a good connection here, because on Twitter over the last, I don't know, a few weeks, there's been, again, the monolith versus microservices thing has come up, and it seems to be an ongoing debate. What I'm curious on is, from your perspective, how does domain-driven design impact the architectural decisions around monoliths versus microservices? Is there a valuable connection here, or are they two kind of separate things to think about?
I mean, there are a couple of things in domain-driven design, a couple of concepts that guide the potential separation of a logical system into different logical parts, like bound contexts on top, as we discussed already. There's a concept of a module that's kind of a subdivision of a bounded context, so each bounded context can consist of different logical modules that help you to define something that's hidden inside and something that's exposed to other modules, and then you can get to these kind of cohesive elements. There's domain-driven design does not form an opinion on what to map those logical concepts to, whether a bounded context is supposed to be a separate process. It could be a build module. It could be whatever. A module could be a Java package or something. If we're sticking to Java, that's actually architectural work, right? To decide what physical abstractions, if we can talk about physics in software or physical
world.
But on each of these levels, processes, build modules, let's say something smaller like packages, you live with different trade-offs of what you can and cannot do anymore.
As an example of this, let's say that you're designing a system and you've got inventory in order. I think that's a good system. And you design it where that is all within a bounded context. And so then in your implementation, you end up having in the same relational database tables that represent both of those things. Mm-hmm. And in some pieces of your application, you do a database join across those two tables. Mm-hmm. That breaking those two things out into separate microservices becomes really challenging. And I think that maybe
counterproductive.
Yeah. Part of the value of domain-driven design in this is that it tells you where you can split things out, because you've bounded the context and you've said, okay, these two things are intertwined. We're doing a database join on these things on the actual implementation side. And so do not try to break your bounded context apart. That would be a bad place to try to do microservices.
Well, and from a management context, it also would help you decide maybe teams working on things. Like if you had a remote team in a different time zone working on a different section, you'd want, maybe that would be your API interface that you want. And those people would just, they would focus on that thing. Anyway.
There's like two primary drivers behind physical separation. One is, and that's the bigger one, even I think it's organizational boundaries, right? A team, which kind of means team structures and also deployment cycles, basically, more from an organizational point of view rather than from a technical deployment point of view. Yeah. The other one is scaling, usually, right? If you have, let's say, in that e-commerce system, if you see that the catalog, just the browsing the catalog is under heavy load, then you might want to consider to have a separate system for that, so that you can basically cover the read load there. There's other options for that as well. You could try caches for these particular URIs or what have you. It's not necessarily, or it's not a necessary thing. to separate that part out if you see that problem. But the organizational arrangement usually is a big driver for that physical separation. Everything else, and we actually see kind of a bit of a trend back to that, is something, or we see the trend to people building what we call modulithic software these days, right?
Modulithic.
So, yeah, that's nice. Kind of like, yeah. Okay, you build something in a that's a single process that still has some internal structure, and that applies actually some means that you would have to apply if you separated it out, but you wouldn't usually don't if you basically keep it contained, because it also means a bit like giving up on some convenience stuff, like you mentioned, James, that stuff like interconnected database tables, right? You could go ahead and still cleanly separate like the data of your, let's say, order module and the order the data of your inventory module, and make sure that you, let's say, just have a store, let's say, the order IDs or product IDs or what have you, but without a foreign key relationship, right? So that you still get the connection. But if you at some point decide to actually to pull out that part of the system, then you are already prepared, and you have your data layer basically prepared. That continues into the way that these individual logical modules interact with each other, whether it's like direct method calls or whether it's like an event that's published on one side of the system and then listened to by the other. That would not necessarily have to be that case, or it have to be that way in a monolithic arrangement. But we already do so because we want to basically establish these logical boundaries within our system, our monolithic system, because it makes the system easier to test, or parts of that mm-hmm. easier to test.
Does the bounded context idea help us to decide what pieces potentially could be split off? And for team reasons or runtime performance reasons or whatever it may be. But is there a connection there?
I mean, you could play, let's say, a very reasonable, like, I'm not saying default mapping, but you could argue, okay, whatever what forms the bounded context, we build as a separate system because we align a team around it. And that's not like everything order or everything inventory as we just already discussed. But that bounded context might have like an internal structure that we then represent as individual modules. And then we have, again, like a mapping step onto either build modules or as we have in this new Spring project here, the Spring modular stuff, we use packages quite a lot, right? We basically say that there's a Java package that forms the entry point into a module. And we give you a few guardrails or means to actually make sure that this modular structure that you've created by just arranging your code in a certain way is you retain that and you're not accidentally introducing like cycles.
I want to hear more about this because I think I saw a little bit and it seemed really interesting. But this is the idea that you're building a Spring project and you're architecting it, organizing it in a way that is able to be modularized later. It doesn't impact you as the developer. Like you're not having to, the developer experience around creating something that's modular and packaged is nice versus the traditional way was that, oh man, like now you got to think about, you know, how you're going to share your interfaces and the contract and how you do contract testing and all this kind of stuff.
Yeah. So the idea of the project is that you can build a Spring Boot application. That's what it's based on, and that you get as a developer, you get the ability to express these logical parts, and you would use Java packages as to do that on a let's say the most high level. What you get with it is means to from these packages is to expose certain APIs like. In the Spring Beans, which is like object instances at runtime that you can invoke, or events that basically are published through the Spring event bus within the JVM. So it's not kind of no messaging at all involved yet, or at this point at least. You get that, and what you get around this is both an ArcUnit-based API to verify that you have a non-cyclic structure, and if you want to and express, like, let's say this module is allowed to only depend on that other, you would be able to do that as well. But as we've seen, a simple non-cyclic arrangement already gives you kind of 80% of the kind of structural degradation prevention, basically. You get the verification, and what you also get is the ability to bootstrap individual modules within that system in a test, so that you can just say, okay, I want to only run the order module, for example, and it would then basically just limit the execution to those beans and what have you. So it's a very, very non-invasive way for developers to, just structure your applications. Non-invasive because everything that's complicated usually puts people off. Yeah. Right? We want to be able to do the right thing in a very easy way.
So like OSGI, but actually like usable and friendly.
I mean, there's been a lot of discussion, and there's still questions that come up with, like, also around JPMS, and OSGI is also another thing. But if you look at those, especially JPMS has been built to modularize the JDK. It's very security focused, and you need the libraries to play into this, right? They have to provide this. None of this is usually the concern of the developers in the first place. If you again, you have your domain.
What the system needs, not what the developer needs.
I want to structure my application following the domain, and I don't necessarily want each module of that to be a separate jar file, which is what JPMS would require.
Yeah.
So it's just, here's my boot app. I just lay out the logical parts, the business driven parts in a certain way. And that's all I care about for now, right?
Yeah.
And it kind of leaves away a lot of the complexity it by also not being like as deep, or it's not like that as deeply ingrained, of course, in the JVM, but it does the trick. So there's a bigger bang for the buck kind of ratio here. And it's kind of that project is basically a technical implementation of stuff that we have conveyed through like presentations or in consultings. Go ahead, structure your application like this, put your configuration code in, do it like this, right? All these recommendations that we've verbally given are kind of now embedded or implemented.
What's the name of the project again?
Spring Modulith, basically.
Spring Modulith.
Modulith. Yeah, we want to help you build modulistic applications. And that doesn't mean, I mean, there's always this discussion about modulith being so close to monolith. Do we tell you to build a single application? No, we don't. It's just a means to whatever system you build, whatever arrangement that is part of, it is likely to have some internal structure.
Yeah.
And we want to help you to express that internal structure and then give you guidance around tests. There's observability features in there, because in a microservices arrangement, you'd usually put something like Zipkin between the systems to be able to track the flow through the through the individual systems. Why shouldn't you have something available in your modulithic application, right? So that you can track that the order module invokes the inventory or what have you, track the number of events that get published, all this kind of stuff. That's kind of exposed to any runtime platform.
So in the microservices versus monoliths, the answer is yes, both, and it's called moduliths.
And sure. Also, there's this quote from Stefan Tilkov. He said, like, we like monoliths so much that we would want to build many of them. And that's kind of the spirit, right? So it's not about like one system or 1,000 systems. It's like, okay, you align the number of systems with your organizational structure, and you still have means to organize within those systems, because like in this public discussion, it's usually like, oh, there's this system And if it's a microservice, then that's the level of granularity and there's nothing in there. It's like just this one thing, which is usually not the case, right? It's like you can rather build a slightly bigger thing that has internal structure.
So embrace Conway's law. Don't fight it.
Yeah. Exactly. Well, yeah. It sort of seems like I would kind of sum this up by saying that domain-driven design, well, we make these decisions when we're programming. And because of our training and our orientation, we make them purely for technical reasons for within our own little world. What domain-driven design does is it says, I can give you information to help you make better decisions, to produce better results, to produce more maintainable, understandable, et cetera, results. That seems like kind of what we're going for here.
Sounds like the value proposition of domain-driven design. It's almost like a system of thinking.
It is.
And giving you a lens to see things through that should help you deliver better business outcomes for what you're building.
But my question that I kind of pitched at you at the beginning was, why is it big now when it's been 20 years since the book got written? What's changed?
I mean, there definitely is a renaissance of that. I mean, I've been starstruck by the book like from the very beginning, and that led to Spring Data Repositories and what have you. But I think that microservices discussion, like the hype that kind of we've seen like 5 years ago at the peak with Netflix, thousands of systems and what have you, that kind of got people rethinking about like, where do we put boundaries, right? And like, do we want to have like two levels of abstraction, or do we want to have multiple ones? And which quality goals do we align with which level of abstraction, right? This kind of organizational stuff at the bound context level, and this boiling down, and how much freedom do we want or do we need in terms of like the choice of technology and what have you, right? Like, do we want to use different programming languages? And if we want to do so, we have to do processes. All these discussions have started with the microservices movement. And it's, I think it's an important piece also is that microservices has been the first architectural style, new architectural style, post the agile software development kind of development. So it's it's breathing that kind of idea or that energy, because you would want to align your microservices with your business capabilities, right? It's kind of they seem to have the same roots to some degree, all these movements, one being the organizational or process side of things and the other one being the technical implementation idea.
But, like Waterfall was much more aligned with monoliths conceptually.
Because you have a project and you build one system to satisfy one project, right? This is kind of it's been that idea, and all this kind of like centered around like different teams doing different things, and then aligning the software structures with that has definitely like, or there's some connection there. And I think that especially the strategic design part of DDD that we kind of like just briefly touched on today kind of connects to that, right? And then that's kind of, oh, there's this book. And let's see what ideas were in there. And then people are coming back to kind of realizing that it's not necessarily about like the technical implementation of microservices, but rather about like modularity and different scopes of modularity at different levels of abstraction that are
and
like
the, and the interface between that and the actual structure of the organization.
Especially the Blue Book making exactly that connection. I mean, the Parnas paper is from what, 79 or something, so it's not particularly.
What was
even
the paper?
Even the DDD book is kind of a like a.
What was
late,
the paper you mentioned?
From the Parnas paper, modularity paper.
Huh. I'll have to read that one. I don't know that one. Do you know this one?
No. Yeah. I mean, I know the name.
Parnas. It's the. I think the if. Anything modularity related is like citing this paper. It's a bit like the Conway's Law thing, the Conway's Law paper. But we can look that up for the show notes, I think.
That sounds great.
So do you have any questions that you want to ask us? And you don't have to. It's just
anything we missed.
Yeah, or anything we missed.
Or maybe also like for the audience, because there's probably like people on the Discord that are like listen to the episode later. I mean, the thing that I'm currently like most interested in is like what strategies to teams apply to when they have to make all these decisions that we've discussed, right? When they when they plan a new piece of software, and what are their drivers behind a decision to like build a separate system or not, right? What is that?
How do teams think through that? And
yeah,
and do they have a architecture team or something that they can go to and discuss that with, or are they being told by an architecture team how to do it? And I'm sure there's a huge variety of setups.
There is this gap between like when you do like things like event storming, right? And you have that wall of post-its, and then you kind of have to somehow translate that into when you get back to your computer, open up your IDE. So there is as I usually say, post-its don't run in production, unfortunately. except you work for Miro, then they do. But
There was an attempt once to run UML models and make that your production.
The idea of taking a drawing and turning it into a program has been a holy grail for a long time. And they always go, the last time I heard it was UML, and they were going, yeah, we're 90% there. We just have to do the last 10%, and then never heard from them again.
Yeah. There is, I think Chris Richardson, you probably know him. Uh-huh. He recently, I have to look it up. He recently posted some, he's formalized this into some kind of process where you basically, you finished your domain analysis stuff, and then how do you get to the decision of what to build as a separate service and what to build as modules within that separate service. We can definitely look that up. I don't find it right now, but yeah.
Anyway. Yeah, I'm sure it's up on his
site. Decision-making in general is fascinating.
I don't know. I have to look this up later.
Great, I'll go find it. Yeah, anything else we missed?
Oh, it's been pretty extensive discussion, I think.
Very educational for me. So,
happy to get some feedback on the Discord channel.
Yes. Sure. Join. I guess we don't often talk about the Discord channel, and we should mention it that we do have a Discord channel.
We do.
It's always in the description of the podcast. And if you want to discuss these things more, join us there.
Yeah.
Thanks, Ollie.
Thanks, Bruce. Thanks, James, for having me.